like to introduce tonight's speaker. Some of you might know him, some of you might not. Reverend Charlie McCorney has lived for many years at Green Gulch Farm and Tel Sahara Zen Centers, and will be teaching soon at Institute for Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, and is very devoted to Dharma and studying Dharma, and I found out today, you might not need to know this, but is the Abhidharma Kosha is this text of kind of Buddhist psychology and study of the mind that Charlie's been kind of specializing in studying over the last years. And there's these 600 verses which he's memorized. The entire text takes like 8 hours to recite. And it's also
Don't test me, please.
We know that difference.
And it's previously memorized the entire Lotus Sutra, which is, you know, about 300 pages. So he has an unusual kind of mind, I think. And we're very happy to have you here tonight. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's good to see you.
Yes, nice to see you.
Good to see you. And so I have been studying Abhidharma Kosha, and I thought I'd talk about a little bit about that text as a whole, and then some specific teachings in there. And Abhidharma Kosha was written by Vasubandhu, and Vasubandhu probably lived around the 5th century, maybe 400 to 480, so that's what some scholars think. And Vasubandhu initially studied Sarvastivada Buddhism, and then probably in what is today Afghanistan is probably where he lived, and then he got interested in another school as well, the Sautrantikas, and Abhidharma Kosha is sort of written while he's what's written as a kind of exposition of this Sarvastivada teachings, but then he's also starting to bring in a lot of critiques of the Sarvastivadins from a more conservative viewpoint, from the Sautrantika viewpoint, which Sautrantika comes just from Sutra, the Sutra followers. And then later in life, he completely converted to Mahayana and became a Yogacara monk. So Sarvastivada and Sautrantika were not Mahayana schools. And so he had he's very intense intellect and kind of restless. He doesn't seem to be too caught up by any particular system. And the Abhidharma Kosha it's an Abhidharma work. And Abhidharma I feel like Abhidharmas were like, you know, before the Mahayana and after the Mahayana came up, Abhidharmas were early Buddhism was growing and transforming. That's expressed in the Abhidharma literature. And so when they had the kind of, their sutra canon was somewhat figured out after about 100 years after the Buddha passed away, but then to incorporate new insights and new teachings, they put these into Abhidharma texts. And a number of schools at that time developed Abhidharma teachings, and the only ones, the two major traditions that survived are the Theravada Abhidharma, and that was, you know, developed mainly in South India and Sri Lanka, and then the Sarvastivada, which developed in Northwest India. And they had some common roots, but then they developed somewhat independently for hundreds of years. So they're quite different. And so Abhidharma Kosha is in this North Indian tradition. And that's also the tradition in which the Mahayana really, that's where it came out of. It was a reaction to that and also a kind of continued evolution. And Abhi means there's a couple of different meanings. For the Theravadas, they usually interpret it as higher. And so Abhidharma means like higher teaching. And this is usually refers to the fact that Abhidharma has a tendency to do away with to some extent to do away with conventional discourse and to try and present the teachings in an ultimate way with without you know, without using you know, inexact but friendly terms. In North India, the usual way they interpret Abhi is facing. So Abhidharma means facing the Dharma. And usually in this case, actually, Dharma meant Nirvana. Nirvana was one of the Dharmas. And Abhidharma, for them, would mean something like facing Nirvana or envisaging Nirvana. And there's a lot of tendencies in what the Abhidharma is about. And some of it's incorporating new teachings. Some of it's trying to take all the teachings in Buddhism and try and make a one cohesive picture out of everything. And whenever there's contradictions in the sutras, they work it out. They find some way to make it all resolve into one picture. And another thing they wanted to do, I think, was you know, to give the teaching a really clear form and cohesive, and then also kind of definitive, a definitive interpretation. And one of the tendencies in Abhidharma is, you know, the sutra literature was quite large from when the Buddha taught, you know, over 45 years. And it was sort of it was a lot to deal with. And so sometimes one of the tendencies of Abhidharma is to try and find a concise way of wrapping up the essential teachings that you can, so you can kind of hold the teachings without having to spend a years of study. And then they would make this really concise thing, and then it would be so concise it'd need a lot of commentary. So then there'd be commentaries on these concise expressions, and those would get very long. Then there'd be another concise expression. So this isn't in the Abhidharma Kosha. It has verses. It has about 600 verses, and those verses are summarizing Sarvastivadin text that's about 10,000 pages long, called the Mahavibhasha. So he takes a huge teaching and consolidates it into these verses. And then those verses, but they're so concise, you know, they need to be expanded again. So then Vasubandhu's commentary on that ends up being about, it's over 1,000 pages. And the story with the Abhidharma Kosha is Vasubandhu studied with Sarvastivada teachers, and then he went back to his hometown and he wrote these verses. And then he sent these verses to his teachers. Everybody was reading it, and they really liked it. And it was kind of this really nice, really coherent, very well-organized presentation of their teaching. And they said, well, please write a commentary. So they sent it back, and he wrote a commentary. And then in the commentary, he ended up criticizing all the essential viewpoints of the Sarvastivadins. And they're very unhappy. There's a number of commentaries written on the Abhidharma Kosha by Sarvastivadins trying to refute all the times he refutes the Sarvastivadins. So Abhidharma Kosha has 9 chapters, and the 9th chapter is basically an appendix. It's kind of probably might have been written earlier and then added on at the end. And so it doesn't have the verses and commentary. It's a different structure. It's just prose. The first 8 chapters have the verse with commentary, And the first two chapters are the fundamental principles, the basic principles. And so this is, I'll talk more about this, but this is the dharmas and causality are the two basic principles that are going to go through the whole teaching. Chapter 3, 4, and 5 form a group. And that group is basically the world of suffering. And then chapters 6, 7, and 8 form a group, and that's the world of liberation. And so chapter 3 is on the world. And so it talks about the human realm, but it also talks about many realms, animal realm, hell realm, and heavenly realms, and talks about all the beings in these realms, and also talks about how beings pass through these realms, constantly being born, living, and dying, and then going through an intermediate existence and being reborn somewhere else, going through all these realms. And the process of that, he describes the 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising. So that teaching for him fits into this description of the world of suffering. And chapter 4 is on karma, or action. And so action is the cause of the world, and the cause of cyclic existence in the world, cyclic suffering. And that includes, bad action leads to painful parts of the world of suffering. Good action leads to pleasant parts of the world of suffering. But both good and bad karma are causes of the world of cyclic suffering. And chapter 5 is on the defilements, or everything that afflicts our minds. And that's the underlying condition. So the action with the underlying condition of the afflictions is what causes the cyclic suffering. If action that doesn't have any defilements underlying it, doesn't lead to suffering. And you could maybe say just the defilements by themselves, if you don't enact them, they don't necessarily lead to the world of suffering. But when you put that condition of the afflictions with the action, that leads to a world of suffering. And then, so then the second group of chapters, 6, 7, 8, chapter 6 is on the path. So this is kind of the path of liberation, or the life of liberation. And chapter 7 is the knowledges. And the knowledges are, in a way, they're the cause of the path, and that the knowledges are the wisdoms. It's through knowledge or wisdom that the defilements are abandoned. And not just that, that it basically becomes through wisdom, the defilements have no way to arise. And then the underlying condition in this case is meditation. So that's chapter 8. So it has in both cases, it's the same structure. But there's the path. The cause of the path is now the knowledge or the wisdom. And the underlying condition for knowledge to be liberating is meditation. And so then he used that basic structure he put all the teachings of Buddhism fit in there somewhere. And so in a way, one of the ways they say, chapters 3, 4, 5 are the impure dharmas. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 are the pure dharmas. And then chapters 1 and 2 are pure and impure dharmas. It's a discussion of all the dharmas. And in chapter 1, the third verse says, apart from discerning the dharmas, there is no way to extinguish the defilements. And it is by reason of the defilements that the world wanders in the ocean of existence. So the main, the essential practice for the Abhidharmakas, the people who study Abhidharma, is discerning the dharmas. And so the first Vasubandhu talks about 5 skandhas, the 5 aggregates, and the 12 ayatanas, or the 12 gates, and the 18 dhatus. And these are all teachings from early Buddhism. And they're ways of 5 skandhas, the 5 aggregates, is from the Heart Sutra. Or it's in the Heart Sutra, the form, or a material form, part of our lives. The mental factor of sensation, the mental factor of conception, and then the 4th skandha is formations, or all the other mental factors, and the 5th skandha is consciousness. And so those 5 skandhas are a way of those include all conditioned dharmas. And in early Buddhism, the primary idea with the 5 skandhas, I think, is that you have this teaching of the 5 skandhas as a way to look at your life without a self, without a separate self, or without an independently existing self, either outside of or inside of the 5 skandhas. So you don't need that to understand your life. And so they would sit studying themselves as the 5 skandhas. And in Abhidharma Kosha, Vasubandhu starts with the 5 skandhas, and he also talks about these other ones, that the 12 ayatanas and the 18 dhatus are other ways of talking about everything that's in our lives. And like the 18 dhatus are 6 are the 5 sense organs of seeing, or of sight, of hearing, of smell, taste, and touch. And then the 6th is they call the organ of the mind. And then for those 6, there's the 6 objects. And that's the next 6 dhatus. And then the next 6 are the 6 consciousnesses. So that by having an organ, an object, and a consciousness, for each of these 6 modalities, they have 18 dhatus. And this is another way of talking. You can put all the dharmas you include everything, all phenomena can be included in this teaching. And so this is another way to study our lives. As Abhidharma developed, a certain way of thinking about phenomena arose, and it's usually called something like a theory of dharmas, or dharma theory. And the idea with dharma theory was that there was dharmas were real, and the 5 skandhas, for instance, they would say those, you define the 5 skandhas in terms of dharmas, and the dharmas are real. The self that we imagine is not real, but the dharmas are real. And this evolved quite a bit, and so this is when they say discerning the dharmas, they're talking about discerning these real you could say constituents of experience. And there's 2 basic ways to study the dharmas. And so one way is to study the characteristic, the individual characteristic of the dharmas. So the dharmas, to be real, they had to be distinct from each other. If 2 dharmas weren't distinct, it was just 1 dharma. And they spent a lot of time actually doing that, of trying to figure out, are these 2 things, or just 1 dharma, just 2 versions of 1 dharma, or are these 2 distinct dharmas? So that was one of their activities that continues to happen and unfold in Abhidharma Kosha. And so they're distinct, and they can articulate what makes them distinct. And so the term for that was sva-lakshana, own characteristic, the characteristic that the dharma has that makes it distinct. And then the other way they studied the dharmas was in terms of common characteristics, or samanya lakshana. And for instance, all dharmas are impermanent, or all conditioned dharmas are impermanent. All conditioned dharmas are suffering. All dharmas are not self, conditioned and unconditioned, and all dharmas are empty. So these were the study of the common characteristics is starting to get into basically the fundamental insights of Buddhism. Thanks. And so, and then another thing to keep in mind here is that the dharmas were not, the reality was not that they were a thing or a substance. The reality was that they had a causal function. So to exist was to have a causal function. And everything actually has more than one causal function, and everything is a result of more than one cause. Everything is a result of many causes, and everything in turn is a cause and condition for other things. More than always, more than one. So there's it's a very interconnected vision of these real causal forces constantly working and interacting. And so one of the ways they unfold the Dharma theory is with the theory of causation. And in the Srivastavadins, in the Srivastavada approach, they had their particular causal theory had four conditions, and the four conditions were from the early sutras, and then they added on some new teachings, which were six causes and five results. And especially the four conditions is the subject of the first chapter of Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which Reverend Kokyo is teaching. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think the reason it's the first chapter there is because these conditions and causes are the way that dharmas were real for the Srivastavadins. And what Nagarjuna is up to is he's kind of undoing some of this, some of the feeling that these dharmas are so real.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
You're studying it so intensely. Is this something you apply to your life?
Well, I feel like it's a way to describe what we do when we're sitting. You know, that. You know, that studying how we happen, and you know that you know, you can study yourself as five skandhas happening, you know, and that for me that just sitting would just sitting includes studying ourselves like this.
And this is something that you do during zazen.
It's my endeavor.
Yeah, it seems like we have such a strong imprint of psychology constituting the self that it's a little bit hard to shift to another system for us unless it's very clear and strong.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel like another way of talking about these dharmas and discerning the dharmas is, you know, we have our thinking, and then when we settle down and we find an intimacy where we're sitting, that could be, for me, a way of talking about discerning the dharmas as we're not necessarily articulating the own characteristic or the distinct characteristic, but for me that's kind of getting in touch with the dharmas in a way. You could say getting in touch with something that's a little more real than spinning in our heads, but something that when we stop thinking and or stop being involved with our thinking, that we, when we settle down and we're intimate, what we find there could be, I think, what they were calling being intimate with the own characteristics of the dharmas. And that based on that intimacy and settled feeling, you can start to see emptiness. You can start to realize emptiness with your body and non-self. And that's, you know, that's studying the common characteristics. And, you know, so that's another way that I think about it. I don't know if that...
So could you define dharmas?
Dharmas are distinct, real causal forces. And so, for instance, like something like a tongue would not be a dharma. But this color, these different colors would be dharmas. And they're distinct causal forces that they cause a perception of an object. And, you know, the color causes a perception. And then, you know, that causes, that's another perception, the touch of it and the sound of it. And so those are all distinct dharmas. The sound, the sight, the touch. And then, so those are dharmas in the material realm. Then many of the dharmas are mental factors. And this includes, there's mental factors that are present in every state of mind. And that includes things like a feeling or a sensation. And that's basically a positive or negative judgment in response to it. Generalized judgment in response to what's happening. And that one was considered particularly important because a negative or positive take on things spins very quickly into, greed or aversion. Another mental factor present in every state of mind is conception. And that's basically... basically, how our mind determines conceptually what we're looking at. You know, so just a bit, like it could just be the floor, just a very simple conception, or just a very simple determination of the object and using a image or word. And then there's also there's mental factors that aren't in every mind, and those could be they usually classify those in moral terms. So there's ones that are good or skillful, and that's things like faith and diligence and non-greed and respect. And then there's mental factors that are present in, they have a category for unskillful minds and also a category for just defiled minds, and these include different things, but like the delusion, sleepiness, well actually torpor and worry. There's also factors of mind that can be present in any state of mind or not necessarily. Sleepiness is one of those. So you can be sleepy. You can have that mental factor in a good, neutral or negative state of mind.
So this is a way of tuning into our experience,
yeah,
moment after moment,
yes,
as it's arising.
Yeah. And particularly paying it, and what they were particularly concerned with also is these kind of wholesome and unwholesome factors, skillful and unskillful factors. But to some extent also I think that it was just to be intimate with what was there, be intimate with what's here. And, they don't say... discerning the dharmas, they don't say, and changing them all into good ones. Actually, more important is just the discerning of the dharmas, being very clear about what the dharmas are in this mind, and what, and with negative emotions, being very clear about when different kinds of negative emotions are arising. And so other dharmas are anger and enmity, jealousy, stubbornness, greed, pride, and things like that.
Do you notice that when you notice these mental factors arising, that you can stop them?
No,
you can
shift
to something else.
No, I don't usually. Well, I don't. Well, that's not my intention. I mean, that's not my effort. You know, my effort more is just to be clear about the dharmas.
Right.
What would you say is the purpose of being clear about the dharmas?
Oh, well, because if you can try to change the dharmas, often the desire to change it is, well, where is that coming from? Are you looking at those dharmas? And then, the wisdom is the cause of abandoning the defilements. That's what I said before. And so, we can try and suppress emotions and move emotions around, but until we actually understand how things are happening, how the common characteristics, until from an intimate place we understand emptiness and not self, we will always be vulnerable to the defilements. But when, according to this, when you're very clear about that, that undercuts the ability for defilements to even arise. Like, the defilements depend on us believing in a self at some level and seeing things as in a certain way to have any hold on us at all.
You would say just by discerning the dharmas, it automatically the insight into no underlying self arises more and more clearly. By that very focus on the different factors.
Well, that I think for the discerning the dharmas is developing that insight. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you actually discerning the dharmas as you're sitting and being very intimate with yourself, then just by the very clarity of the discernment, then there isn't, they don't even arise. It's not even a question of that the clarity of the discernment changes them. It's just that...
Strictly speaking, the clarity of the discernment doesn't touch the defilements. It just takes away all the ground that they could have to jump off of into
their life. So it gives a whole bunch of space around the defilements, and then they don't have any power.
Yeah, they don't have any power.
It's like creating space.
In a way. Yeah, that's a way of talking about it. Yeah, I think that could be that's a good
image.
That's
kind of my experience, my way of describing my experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, creating space.
Is that your experience?
Yeah, it actually is. Because I feel like when the defilements are present, or when I feel I experience them as contractions or tightnesses and this kind of all bogged everything glommed together, crowded like that. And so when I can allow that to be there without trying to make it different, whatever configuration it's taking in terms of its globbiness, then there's some space around it. I'm not the same as the globbiness then, completely. or I don't identify with it, or I don't know how to talk about it. Something like that. Feels more spacious inside. Breathing still feels easier. There's more... more room. More space.
That's wonderful.
Well,
I don't always find that the case.
Well, I don't always find it the case either, but that happens. That happens.
It sort of depends on how identified we are with the dharmas that are arising. Some of them we're less identified with. It seems to me that we can let them go or have more space or be expanded by the awareness. Mm. But if there's a lot of identity, there's a strong push.
By identity, Charlie was talking about greed or grasping. Would that be identity or aversion?
Strong history.
History. Mm.
That the empty self is identified. Mm. with a particular
habit pattern,
defilement. I guess it's that link between knowing, recognizing, and experiencing some release. I don't know what the Abhidharma can contribute to that.
In terms of
between the difference, the leap between knowing this is a this is irritation, this is anger, this mm-hmm. is judgment. I get it, and then pow, you say something or do something in the midst of all that arising. Instead of all that arising releasing you from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they would say that the development of insight is where the release, where a definitive release is coming from. And, you know, in a way, by letting go, you get a non-definitive release. But if you're just letting go, you can be released from defilements. But it's but they can come back when you stop focusing on letting go. If that's like your meditation practice, but that letting go is also how insight can touch your life. And if you just think about the teachings, they won't go that deep. But in the context of letting go and being intimate, the teachings can touch your life really deeply. And then that's insight.
Yeah, it seems motivation is so necessary here. Motivation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there needs to be quite a bit of conviction.
I just had this thought as I was listening to this exchange and listening to what you said. And are you saying that the noticing of this mechanism is letting go? I've never thought of letting go as noticing. I always think of letting go as stopping something. And I'm realizing that actually could be really, really so not true. Letting go is actually seeing it rather than grasping and thinking that it's, and not having any consciousness of it and letting it run me without being aware of it. If I'm actually naming and seeing, oh, there it is, there's that mechanism, it just occurred to me, could that be letting go?
That sounds pretty good.
Letting go of the grasping.
Yeah.
Whereas I think often, commonly, we think of letting go as, bad thought.
Yeah.
Go away. But what you're actually saying, it's like, no, actually, study it deeply.
Yeah.
Fully.
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
But really.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, I wonder, are you meaning by mechanism what... is it the same, your sense of mechanism, the same as what Charlie was saying about what happens what's happening in this moment? Is that, whatever all the habit, are you meaning habit, like habit pattern?
Yeah, when you were describing this, I just heard it like a mechanism, kind of like, we have these sense organs and there's the objects, and then there's the perception of it, and just this whole way that we construct our reality, what we call our reality. And it sounded like what you were saying when you first responded to Catherine was, when she said, do you try to stop it or something? You said, no, I'm studying it. And it just was sort of this idea of just really looking at. Yeah, so that's what I meant by, that's what I heard. I heard it as a mechanism.
Mm-hmm. I think there's, causal process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, causal process.
There's so many conditions and causes impinging on each moment that it ends up being very unmechanistic.
Yeah, causal process. I like that. Yeah. That's a better term.
Yeah. But Charlie, did we stop you on your, you were on the trajectory that
was... I could just mention the four conditions.
I wondered where you were
heading. I was heading towards the four conditions, partially because that's connected to Nagarjuna.
Do you have time for you to... Yeah,
I'll spend a few minutes. There's there's kind of a causal condition, a object condition, the equal mediate condition, and a kind of a predominant condition. And the causal condition is it's kind of like the in a way, like it has a feeling of like the main thing that's leading to something, the main cause. And so, for instance, when you plant a seed, that can be the cause, but then like rain and sunlight are supporting conditions. So without the rain and the sun, it's not going to grow. But without the seed, doesn't matter how much rain and sun there is, you're not going to have a plant. So that's one way of thinking about the cause. And then I won't get in, but anyway, then the Sarvastivadins take cause and they split that into six causes. And let's not do that. The object condition is this is just for referring to a mind, a consciousness, that every consciousness has an object that's a condition for its arising. And so there actually are states of mind which don't have an object, so they don't have that condition. And there are, and then things don't have an object condition. But all minds, except for these special meditation states, have an object condition. And the picture of consciousness here is not, it's not like there's a conscious, it's not like there's a stream of consciousness that things go in and out of. But that an object comes up and a consciousness comes up of the object, and there's always this object condition. And and I think Dogen, when he says in Genjo Koan, to carry the self forward and experience myriad things is delusion. Mm-hmm. That's how I hear that. That you have this consciousness that's going around, and it's like, oh, what's over here? What's over here? I'm the same thing. As opposed to things coming forth and experiencing the self. So each thing comes forth and the consciousness arises with it, and it's a kind of a new creative act each time. The equal immediate condition is, this is also for minds, and this is that each moment of consciousness depends on the previous moment of consciousness. And partially, I think what they're getting at here was I think partially just to, I think the main idea was like that there is continuity in our lives even though there is no self. And for instance, like even though we meet this object over here, we meet this object over here, we're not completely different persons, because there's always this a series of consciousnesses. There's always one consciousness falling from another consciousness. To some extent, I talk about there's the mind organ. One of the ways they define the mind organ was the previous moment of consciousness. And the eye organ, to some extent, can feel distinct from an eye object and a visual consciousness. But the mind organ, I don't think they would say it was the brain. I think for them, actually, you didn't really need a mind organ in the moment. But the previous moment's consciousness has this function of being this necessary condition for this moment's consciousness together with the object. And so they called it the organ. And then the predominant condition is, it's just everything else. and to some extent, one way they say is that, you know, even if something doesn't seem to be causally related to you at all, it's not obstructing whatever's happening right now. And so they actually even said that, you know, nirvana doesn't obstruct the arising of each moment of samsara. So to that extent, like, nirvana is a predominant condition for samsara, even though nirvana is unconditioned and doesn't actually have any causal force in the world. So those are the four conditions. And I think it's wonderful to be intimate with our lives, and it's wonderful for that to open. And I think they liked it so much they wanted the dharmas to be real. And then the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra just empties it all out. But there's no arguments. There's no explanation. It's just like, no five skandhas. There is no... The five skandhas aren't real. I mean, they're not non-existent either, but there's no separate five skandhas and emptiness. And Nagarjuna, he presents arguments to help us, to help our mind develop conviction. You know, so the Heart Sutra is, it's just kind of a statement, but it doesn't convince us. And Nagarjuna is like trying to convince us, trying to help our logical mind get on board with this.
Is not real the same as not as empty?
In this case, yeah. Well, I mean, you know,
So by real,
empty in the Heart Sutra is empty of ultimate existence, or empty of being really existent,
or substantial.
Yeah.
So the other guys, or the Abhidharmas, Abhidharma guys, thought that the skandhas were real, that they each one had some substance to it.
That
substantial.
It's a very different perspective. The Abhidharmakas, they felt that if the dharmas weren't real, mm-hmm. if the causal forces aren't causal forces, how is anything arising? How does anything arise? Mm-hmm. So Vasubandhu was familiar with Nagarjuna, mm-hmm. and he doesn't talk about him except for one sentence in the Abhidharmakosha. And he basically just says, you know, the people who say everything's empty are nihilistic. And then he goes on. He feels like they actually deny dependent co-arising when they say everything's empty. But I think Nagarjuna had a change of heart at some point. And Vasubandhu. Yeah. He really loved Prajnaparamita later in life.
In terms of these four conditions, the example of like sense perception, as I understand it, the object condition would be like the color, and as I've understood it, the dominant condition, part of the dominant condition is the organ, and then there's the previous moment of consciousness is the antecedent condition. But do you know in that sense experience example what the causal condition? They're usually double listed, I guess.
There's the six causes, and the five of those are identified with that, with the cause condition, and one of those is sahabhuhetu, coexistent cause, and. Coexistent causes the mind and all the mental factors, and that's also called samprayuktika hetu. So there's that kind of simultaneous causation of that consciousness of that object with all the mental factors happening in that moment would be one of the other causes of this moment would be, for instance, like the object you know, there's certain factors of mind that are drawing your attention to that object, that are identifying the object, choosing which aspect. Yeah, and then also to some extent, you know, there you could have a completely receptive moment of consciousness, but there, you know, in a moment of consciousness, there'd also usually be some karmic causation. So then that would be actually leading, you know, some kind of intentional act, you know, in relation to either thinking, voice, or body, in relation to the moment. And the other causes, you know, I mean, you could also look at it in terms of the results too. You know, and then there's other, that's another approach, and then you know, that's the five results, and so that another way of
just sometimes that cause or condition, they talk about it as like the primary.
Yeah,
and you talk about that too.
And that's the usual definition. Yeah.
But I could see it almost like deciding to look at this color. It's like, in a way, that's the main thing, making that sensory experience.
Yeah, that there's actually quite a bit of mental activity producing an experience. Like, the object is part of it, but then all the mental factors, like those ever-present factors, usually those are, the reason they're ever-present is that you need them to have an experience. Mm-hmm. And if you take them away, actually, like, to some extent, you lose the integrity of consciousness, and you can't really have a discernible experience. You know? And so, in Sarvastivada, there was 10 of those ever-present.
So how did this move into the Mahayana? Or have we already...
Well, I'd say, you know, in India...
Wasn't that where you...
Well, you know, one major strand is the Madhyamaka and Prajnaparamita, which is saying these dharmas are empty. Mm-hmm. And there's basically, you could see as a reaction against, like, these people saying the dharmas are real. Mm-hmm. And that they spent a lot of time arguing about which ones were real. So they're also, I think, reacting to that activity of arguing about which ones are real. But then Yogacara, which comes after Madhyamaka, and Vasubandhu is one of the founders of Yogacara, usually regarded as one of the founders. He brings a lot of this Abhidharma into Yogacara context. And he includes some ideas from Yogacara Sutras, and you know, continues to evolve his articulation of what's happening. And so Yogacara has lists of dharmas, but then sometimes they say, you know, but they're all empty, but they still have a list, you know, and they teach the list, and it, you know, and it's different from the Sarvastivada. There's certain differences. And for instance, it includes things like Alaya Vijnana, which is, you know, the storehouse consciousness. They don't teach that in Sarvastivada at all, but they integrate that into the Dharma teaching of the Yogacara. So I think Yogacara is more of an outgrowth than a reaction against Abhidharma as a whole. Well, I think we should stop because it's 7:34. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Illusions are impossible, I vow to rend them. Dharma needs are boundless, I vow to render them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow.